So early voting began yesterday, and as I was thinking about when I was going to go vote between now and November 1st, a friend and a colleague from Colgate called me yesterday, and she asked me if I would agree to be on a panel on Election Day with other Christians to talk about how do we as Christians who hold different political positions and doctrines refrain from the nastiness of partisanship in light of the possible outcome of this election and simply love each other as a witness to the world. And my first thought was, is God trying to tell me something? But then I thought, you know what? This is a great question, right? It's a great question. And my next thought went to my Uncle Tommy. My Uncle Tommy is the youngest of my father's brothers, and he's the only Republican in my family, a family full of Democrats of several generations back. I don't even know how he does it. But do we love him any less? No. Do we treat him badly or differently than we treat the Democratic members of our family? Nope. Do we tease him? Yes. And he teases us. But you know what? My Uncle Tommy is one of my favorite uncles because he never lets politics get in the way of his love for his family and vice versa. Love is the commandment that drives our discussions in our family, not our politics. What we agree on are certain family values, like families stick and stay together, like our love for each other has to be stronger than any disagreements that we could ever have, or that we can speak the truth to each other, but then we have to let it go so that we can re-engage in love. My favorite is if we can't laugh about it, then we're taking ourselves way too serious. And finally, the final principle in our family is that our allegiance at the end of the day is always to God. If God is in it, then we are for it. And that our faith in God and our teachings of Jesus is always the place where we find common ground. And so this works inside of my family, but the truth is that there really is nothing more than our politics, right, that can take us out of the commandment of Jesus to love. We see it on social media, right? We see it in our families, we see it in our communities, and no one is more aware of this than Jesus, who is addressing these two groups of religious leaders who have opposing platforms of belief in the gospel, the Sadducees and the Pharisees. The Sadducees were the kind of holiness movement of Jesus' time. They believed that holiness was found in the temple. They believed in the literal interpretation of text from the Torah alone. And they didn't believe in the resurrection or the afterlife. And their main focus was to concentrate the religious practice and duties on the temple and to prioritize priestly prerogatives. Now, the Pharisees, on the other hand, were different. They were a kind of democratic movement. They believed that all people should be responsible for maintaining this close relationship between God and God's people. They believed that holiness was found in the law, whether you went to the temple or not, that every Jewish man, woman, or child, in a way, was responsible to keep God's commandments and God's law. And so the Pharisees were big on teaching that law to the community. And they believed that their work would benefit really the whole of society, because as long as God's people obeyed the commandments, they would have God's blessing and God's protection. So it is these two groups in the gospel that Jesus encounters today. First, the Sadducees approach him, and that story isn't in here, but that just comes just before this gospel. They approach Jesus with a question designed to entrap Jesus, and they ask him about a woman who married seven brothers and they didn't have children, and so when they all die, whose wife will she be? And Jesus in the resurrection, and so Jesus silences them by telling them that they have erred in their understanding of the scriptures and the power of God as it relates to resurrection and afterlife, that they will not marry but be like angels, and that God is a God of the living and not a God of the dead. And so, silenced by that answer, we come to this next piece in the gospel. The second group steps up, the Pharisees. And they have their question. They have designated someone from their group to approach Jesus, which isn't about the afterlife, but this life right here, this life in front of us. And so they go to Jesus, say, "Teacher, which commandment in the law is the greatest?" It's like asking your parents, right? What's the most important rule you want me to follow out of all the ones you taught? Just give me one. Or asking your boss, what's the most important value we should live into at this company? But Jesus hears their question and he freely answers it. He answers this question because although he knew it was designed to test him, he doesn't care because it's a great question. It's almost as Jesus was waiting for somebody to finally ask the right question. And so as that question lingers, he answers it. And he tells them, "You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, and with all of your mind." To be all in, to be all in, to love God with everything, our heart, our emotions, and our thinking. I don't know about you, but sometimes it can be very easy for me to love God with some of those and keep something for myself, right? To turn my heart over to God or my emotions, but keep my thinking, or vice versa. But Jesus seems to invite them and invite us into closing any gap that keeps us from giving God every part of ourselves to the work and experience of love with God and with our neighbor. Wow. I remember when my grandson was about 4 years old and he was having a tantrum. And he was kicking me and he was swinging at me like four-year-olds sometimes do. And I was able to grab him up in my arms and I held him as he tried to flail. And I said to him, "Pumpkin, in our family, we don't hurt each other. We love each other. When you love, it comes with a responsibility to not just think of yourself, but of all the people that God has placed in your life. You and I, we've been placed in each other's life. And so we have a responsibility to love and to care for each other and to not hurt or harm each other. So I'm going to do that for you. And I need you to be willing to do the same for me. So when I let you go, let's start over. I really do love you. And I know that you really do love me." Now, I'd like to tell you that that fixed it. But I can't. I will tell you that I had to hold him two more times and keep repeating that mantra before he could pull his heart, his emotions, and his thinking together. But we did get there. How was I able to do that? By thinking about all the times when God was all in and held me through my tantrums and hard times in life until I could get it together. And so this first commandment was really helpful to me, especially in my marriage. I remember once my late husband and I were having a really hard time in our marriage, and we were so angry and we were feeling hurt by each other, and I could just feel myself ready to blow a gasket. Anybody ever felt that? In that moment, though, I had two choices. I could explode all of my pain all over him that probably would not have come out right, or I could take my heart, my emotions, and my thinking to God and let God call me back, like through the love of this first commandment, with the hope of being called back to who I'm really called to be, in the same way that I was able to call my grandson back to who he was called to be. And so I chose the second option, and God filled every part of me with the love that I needed. And then I could engage in a way that preserved his humanity and my own. And so when Jesus says that the greatest commandment is to love God with all of your heart, and all of your soul, and all of your mind, He knows that love is powerful, that it's life-changing, that it's world-changing. It changes the world inside of us and the world outside of us. And there are many scriptures that help us to understand the power of that love that I absolutely love to reflect on and meditate on. Like, love covers a multitude of faults, or perfect love casts out fear. Love is bound to the action of giving. My other favorite is, God so loves the world that God did what? Gave. God's only begotten Son, gave us Jesus. And so we're being constantly called by Jesus to live in this powerful state of love. Love with God and love with neighbor. Because our lives are changed by loving God with every part of us and letting God love us with every part of God. Think about how that has happened for you. And if it hasn't happened, how do you make this happen? How do we make this happen in our lives? Do we have to wait for conflict? No. We could get up 30 minutes early every morning and sit with God over coffee or tea or my favorite, hot chocolate. Or we could listen to meditation music. We could read scripture. We could set aside prayer time. We could spend time with God in nature, maybe going for a hike or a walk. There's a parishioner, Catherine Valeroy, who told me that she created a special room in her house, a sanctuary for herself and God to be together, and that room was her refuge. Jim Smith, who directs our prison outreach, gets up every morning to join God in the sunrise, and then he writes reflections, beautiful, insightful reflections. And so God, in this first commandment, Jesus understands that God has to be our filling station. Because when God pushes love into us, God actually pushes God's self into us so that we have what we need. So once we leave that filling station of God's love, Jesus says to the Pharisee, and there's one more. The second commandment is about love too. It's about love in action. Once we're filled up, he says, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And that the whole law and the prophets depend on these two, love of God and love of neighbor. Because Jesus knows that love isn't just for us, it's for the world. What the world needs now is love, right? And so when we love our world, we take care of it. We take care of our earth. As Mother Earth Community is inviting us as a parish to consider taking care of our earth by participating in solar farms or recycling or reducing our meat intake to reduce our carbon footprint, knowing that we only have about 10 years or more of a window to address global warming and climate change. So they call us to love in action. When we love our world, we address racism and oppression. Last week, the Faith Leaders Roundtable that I'm a part of met with the new police chief and asked her to identify the major policing changes that she will undertake and implement. And she said it's a little premature because she's writing it right now. And so we're looking forward to seeing what that is. But she laid out some initial work of gathering information, adequately staffing the police force for leadership, and then looking at policies. I asked her, in light of the policing blueprint developed in 1819, if she really believed we could get to public safety for people of color with simple reforms. And she said, I am a history buff, and I know that this blueprint was patterned after the slave patrols, but I am committed to doing the best that I can. She was aware of systemic challenges. And as we were talking with her about that, part of that question was that as a group, we have been working as a subcommittee of faith leaders on this roundtable of developing a PowerPoint of what a new blueprint of policing can look like for Rochester. And right now, it's going through some processes of being put in front of stakeholders. And our hope is to offer this as a redesign, as a work of love for neighbors throughout our community. This week, many of you, over 55 of you, joined us for our parish forum on racial justice and the church's response to it. It was an amazing conversation, and we know that we have a long road ahead of us, but how exciting is this work? The work of ending racism is a work of love for neighbor. It's always a powerful, life-changing, world-changing work of love. Love of neighbor is found in the ordinary and in the extraordinary, but in the very ordinary ways that we take care of each other. And so what Jesus is asking in the love commandment, everybody can do. It's something that we all can do, and many of you do it every day. It simply begins with neighbors who know what is going on in the lives of the people around them. This kind of love, friends, this love requires the knowledge of the other. It is the very love that Jesus speaks about. And we're being called to that love all the time. We're being called to love our neighbors in our mental health community through the volunteer and fundraising efforts that will help us provide quality mental health services to the under and uninsured in our mental health center. And you are making that happen. Many of you have signed up to provide food gift cards so that struggling families can have a meal for Thanksgiving and children can wake up to gifts on Christmas through our Adopt a Family program. You are doing the work of loving your neighbor. When Rosemary Chirici was dying, I went to visit her, and I learned that a group of parishioners and friends of Rosemary's, along with her family, all signed up to take 24-hour shifts to be with her, to make sure that she didn't spend any of her last days alone. I was so touched by that. Mimi Youngman told me that she spent times laughing with her at 3 o'clock in the morning, reminiscing, feeding her ice chips, holding her hand. And I thought, what a beautiful display of friends coming together, modeling what it looks like to love your neighbor. Last year, my neighborhood lost power, and every house on my street was completely dark, pitch dark. And so I was scurrying around thinking, where did I do with that candle? Probably sure you've had that feeling, right? You don't need them until you have an outage. And as I was looking for my candles, I heard a knock on the door. I went to the door, and to my surprise, it was my neighbor, Dave Baxter. And there he was, standing with his hand full of battery-powered lighting. He was going door to door to every neighbor, and he was handing out this lighting so that none of us would be in the dark. Dave was practicing loving his neighbor. And if you walk into our Spiritus office during the week, you'll find a poster hanging in this hallway. And it's a picture of Dr. King with a beautiful quote that says, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." And what does he mean? He means that when everything is dark, you can't drive out the darkness by adding more darkness. Instead, you light the place up with love. You can't drive out hate with more hate. You push it out with love. And that's what Jesus is inviting us to this morning. The love that we're invited to share with God and with others is the same love that God offers to us and asks us to offer to the poor, to the oppressed, and to those who are hurting in our world. Because God really loves all of humanity. And I think during these times of election politics, it's really important to remember that. Jesus invites us through these love commandments to keep doing the same, to keep loving one another, the Democrats and the Republicans, the white people and the people of color, the police and its citizens. And so, friends, today Jesus gives us a formula, an incredible formula of how to change the world. And it's captured in simply one word, love.